Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 153 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. About the number 153, if you can count to 17, you can verify that if you add up all those numbers, you get 153. And it's also the sum of 1 factorial through 5 factorial. 5 factorial is, if you don't already know, 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. Well, I guess you don't need the times 1. And in the Gospel of John, one of the miracles was Jesus catching 153 fish. Big ones, although whether Jesus exaggerated the size of the fish, we'll never know. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners. But if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. And now for a little feedback. George Kent, who's a professor emeritus from the University of Hawaii, an expert on the human right to food, wrote regarding the paper on which I based episode 151 on the Ebola vaccine. David, this is great stuff. I'd like to see comparably sharp critical analysis in the research on food, nutrition, and diet. So much of it is nonsensical. I think George needs to listen to more of my past podcasts and radio shows, and hopefully I'll do more on food, nutrition, and diet in the future. I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about. Some sad news as well. Terry Michael, a former guest on the show, has passed away from pneumonia. A gay man and a journalist and a critic of the HIV/AIDS dogma, he was interviewed on our March 7th 2017 discussion of PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, the insanity of giving toxic AIDS drugs to all sexually active gay men and other people who have or might have an HIV-positive partner. Terry was a friend of mine, and I had no idea that he was ill until he had passed away. He ended up in the hospital with pneumonia for several weeks before he succumbed. And I know some people will jump to the conclusion that since he was a gay man, he must have been HIV positive and therefore died of AIDS. But as far as I know, he was not HIV positive. People, unfortunately, get pneumonia all the time, and it claims a lot of lives. Rest in peace, Terry. There's been a lot said about James Damore's manifesto, which led to him getting fired from Google. I guess another way to describe it is, as Gizmodo did, the media outfit that started the whole fuss, an anti-diversity screed. Oh, the Oxford English Dictionary describes a screed as a harangue, a lengthy discourse, or gossipy letter. The word derives from the sound of tearing cloth. It's not a compliment. It seems that everyone came down on one side or the other. Either he's an out-of-touch misogynist pig, as Gizmodo implied, or he's a brave anti-PC freethinker who was punished for stating politically incorrect truths. I wonder how many people who hold strong views on one side or the other have actually read it. When I did read it, there were some parts I agreed with, some parts I was skeptical of, some parts I completely disagreed with, And other parts just didn't make a whole lot of sense. But I didn't see why it was that terrible that it was a firing offense. And it wasn't as bad as the letter from the president of Google, which, like Gizmodo, didn't even mention the name of James Damore. So this is from the CEO Sundar Pichai of Google. First, let me say that we strongly support the right of Googlers to express themselves. Much of what was in the memo is fair to debate, regardless of whether a vast majority of Googlers disagree with it. However, portions of the memo violate our code of conduct and cross the line by advancing harmful gender stereotypes in our workplace. Our job is to build great products for users that make a difference in their lives. To suggest a group of our colleagues have traits that make them less biologically suited to that work is offensive and not okay. It is contrary to our basic values and our code of conduct, which expects each Googler to do their utmost to create a workplace culture that's free of harassment, intimidation, bias, and unlawful discrimination. The memo has clearly impacted our co-workers, some of whom are hurting and feeling judged by their gender. Our co-workers shouldn't have to worry that each time they open their mouths to speak in a meeting, they have to prove that they are not, like the memo states, being agreeable rather than assertive, showing a lower stress tolerance, or, quote, being neurotic. At the same time, there are co-workers who are questioning whether they can safely express their views in the workplace, especially those with a minority viewpoint. They too feel under threat, and that is also not okay. People must feel free to express dissent. So to be clear again, many points raised in the memo, such as the portions criticizing Google's training, questioning the role of ideology in the workplace, and debating whether programs for women and undeserved groups are sufficiently open to all, are important topics. The author had a right to express their views on these topics. We encourage an environment in which people can do this, and it remains our policy to not take action against anyone for prompting these discussions. These past few days have been very difficult for many at the company, and we need to find a way to debate issues on which we might disagree while doing so in line with our code of conduct. I'd encourage each of you to make an effort over the coming days to reach out to those who might have different perspectives from your own. I will be doing the same. The end of the memo. It seems to be trying to have both sides. It's important to encourage discussion, but when you do something that is, quote, not okay, you're going to be fired. It's really not totally clear to me exactly what was not okay in the memo. I agree that there are things in the memo that I disagree with, but was it right to fire the person or to have a better discussion? Perhaps Damore could be challenged to support his viewpoints more. If they're wrong, he wouldn't be able to do that. And maybe a debate could ensue. But if I'm going to encourage a debate, let's get a little bit of background information that might help us with this discussion. First, I did read several articles supporting Damore, and I found it interesting that all were written by women. I do believe that men are scared to write on gender issues. I'm a little bit nervous about this conversation. People always talk about having a conversation, but I think a man who talks about gender differences having real consequences in choice of education and job is treated a little bit like the uncle who gets drunk and regales the Thanksgiving dinner with stories of his days in the KKK while his niece is sitting there with her black boyfriend. I agree there need to be limits on free speech, but Damore was not advocating violence. He was not advocating the firing of women who work at Google. He was saying that there may be gender differences at play, or gender preferences at play, something that appears possible to discuss as long as it doesn't impact economically important differences in society, but is not politically correct when talking about employment. I think it's clear that there are gender-specific preferences and differences, but I don't think that can explain why Google has about 20% female programmers. The performance of women in education is overall significantly ahead of men based on a National Science Foundation list of statistics for 2004 through 2014 for the United States. In 2014, there were 809,000 male bachelor's graduates and 1,081,000 female. That's a pretty significant greater number for women. Science and engineering degrees, bachelor's degrees, are lower, but have achieved parity. In 2004, there were slightly more women graduating with bachelor's degrees than men, and that's been true for 9 out of the 11 years covered by the survey. Essentially, there's total equality at the level of science and engineering bachelor's degrees. But there are significant differences between the sectors of science and engineering. For example, women are consistently slightly ahead in agricultural sciences. They're consistently significantly ahead in social sciences, 55% of degrees, biological sciences, almost 60%, and psychology, 77% in 2014. Women are consistently behind in earth, atmospheric, and ocean sciences, about 38% of degrees in 2014, maths, about 42%, and physics, 40%. And women are really far behind in engineering, where they are only about 20% of degrees, and guess what? Computer science at 18%, which I'll note is actually lower than the percentage of women in Google. Google is actually a little bit ahead based on new graduates, and one would expect employment statistics to actually reflect the past, because everybody who's employed got their degree in the past. So as the percentage of women increases, the percentage in employment will increase more slowly until it achieves parity. I think it's a reasonable question to ask how much of the differences between the percentage of women getting degrees in the different sectors is due to innate gender differences, how much is due to the different gender programming that occurs through childhood and throughout life, and how much due to anti-female experiences throughout education and work, where women feel like they're not going to be welcome in a certain profession. Going back to childhood, if girls are more likely to play with dolls and boys with trucks, how much is due to their innate biology, and how much because parents and others enforce gender stereotypes, e.g. by deciding what types of toys to buy? Having raised 2 girls and 1 boy, I know that it's a mixture. It's a mixture of innate biology, and it's a mix, and it also includes messages from society. I saw this as my children started to go to school, and they started to conform more to their gender at this point. But that's not to say there weren't some gender-conforming behaviors that occurred before. I shouldn't say I know this. It's what I feel, having raised children. It's easy to convince yourself of pretty much anything in this area. You can say that it's 100% innate. Girls are girls because they have their chromosomes. Or you could think it's entirely programmed by gender. I really believe the truth is somewhere in the middle. And also, if you look at an individual basis, there are clearly men and women who do not like the bounds of gender conformity. And I think that's fine. How would society know that it's reached a point where women have the ability to achieve their potential as much as men? And I certainly don't believe men can achieve their potential in a society where your financial resources are so important and there are prejudices against different races, religions, and sexual orientations depending on where you live. You could say that having achieved parity in science and engineering degrees, we should lay off programs to encourage women. Or should we focus in areas where they are currently far behind, like computer science and engineering? Does this mean that we should be now helping more men get interested in psychology, biology, and the social sciences? And even then, if you looked at it in a more granular fashion, the different segments of biology degrees and biology employment, you would probably still see significant differences in certain areas. This could go on forever, and there are people making a living off studying and rectifying gender differences, so they certainly don't ever want to announce that the nirvana of total equality has been reached. Continuing with the statistics, women reached almost 60% of master's degrees awarded in 2014. Again, these are U.S. statistics. They are being awarded slightly more than half in the sciences, but just under a quarter of master's degrees in engineering. There are, again, big differences between domains, with computer science as one of the lowest, not the lowest, but it's still 31%, which is actually higher than the percentage of bachelor's degrees. And psychology is the highest at 78%. Women broke parity with men in PhDs somewhere between 2004 and 2014, and the fraction of science and engineering PhDs is above 40% female and rising. It's almost 50% in science, but only 23% in engineering, although it's rising there too. Education comes first and then a job. So what about employment statistics, which one would expect would be a little bit behind? The National Science Foundation has statistics from 2006 to 2015 rather than 2004 to 2014 for educational statistics, but it's a similar period of time. For all jobs held by a person with a degree, bachelor's, master's, or PhD, women are now close to parity. 11.9 million jobs in 2015 that required a degree were held by women, and 13.4 million by men. That's 47%. In science and engineering, women are still far behind, around 28%. Does this indicate a lag in time or unique prejudices, so that even when a woman graduates with a degree in science and engineering, they're discouraged from employment in that area? I guess as the statistics go on, we'll see. Interestingly enough, women hold 24% of computer programming jobs, which is higher than the rate of graduation, also higher than the rate at Google. The lowest percentage I could find was mechanical engineers, which definitely seems like a stereotypical male job choice, playing with trucks and bridges and machines and things like that. Only 9% of these jobs are held by women. At the other extreme, not surprisingly, 73% of psychology jobs are held by women. In broader categories, medical occupations that require degrees are held 70% by women. Is this because people in this profession are less prejudiced and more open-minded to having female workers? Or because more of these jobs involve regular or flexible hours, have good benefits such as sick leave, and are seen as the caring professions? What are the factors? I know that when I was studying in university, I never thought about the lifestyle I would have based on what I was studying, which was biology. I never thought whether my job, well, biology and computer programming, actually, which is kind of relevant to the Damor Manifesto. I never thought whether my job would involve a lot of travel, and never thought, well, would I like that or not? I didn't think about whether my work would be mostly solitary or mostly in a group, whether I'd need to dress up every day, or if I could get away with shorts and a dirty t-shirt. How compatible would my job be with having a family? Would I earn a lot of money? Was that important to me? When it comes to women, there's the biological reality that only biological women can have babies. Also, breastfeed. It's known that 6 months exclusive breastfeeding is best for the baby. So if a woman has just two babies and wants to do the best for her child by breastfeeding for 6 months, that could be a big hit on their career. Some jobs are going to be more compatible with taking time off with children, either maternity leave or when children are sick, than others. Do women tend to be the caregiver because they want to, or because their male partners push them into it? I suspect it's a mixture. Should women have the ability to negotiate work-life family balance with their partner on an equal footing? Well, obviously, yes. But if the way we say that this has been achieved is when the outcomes are equal, that's denying the possibility of biological differences. It's hard to see how we would know when we get to the point where women are making these choices as constrained or unconstrained as men. We could use the existing situation as proof that the existing differences are biological. But that makes no more sense than saying that the existing gender differences in education, job, and caregiving are totally imposed by society. I'm sure there's a lot of research in this area that I'm not familiar with, and if you know of researchers who've tried to tease out the different reasons for women's choice in education, employment, and lifestyle, I'd really be interested in contacting them and trying to arrange a future interview. So let's get to Damor's manifesto or street or white paper or whatever you want to call it and see what he actually said. Quote, "I value diversity and inclusion. I'm not denying that sexism exists and don't endorse using stereotypes. When addressing the gap in representations in the population, we need to look at population level differences in distributions. If we can't have an honest discussion about this, then we can never truly solve the problem." So is this an honest opinion, or is this the kind of statement that people make. Some of my best friends are black before they go on to criticize black people. Damore says, differences in distributions of traits between men and women may in part explain why we don't have 50% representation of women in tech and leadership. Discrimination to reach equal representation is unfair, divisive, and bad for business. I think the problem with this is that we're not close to 50%. If we were at 40%, you might be able to say, well, the differences in computer science are due to biology, but I have a hard time believing that 20% is the natural level, even though that's similar to what is found in general in employment and in education. It's possible that far fewer women than men want to be computer scientists, but it's hard to see what's in the job of computer science that would make it so unattractive to women. Damore goes on for his background. People generally have good intentions, but we all have biases which are invisible to us. Thankfully, open and honest discussion with those who disagree can highlight our blind spots and help us grow, which is why I wrote this document. Google has several biases, and honest discussion about these biases is being silenced by the dominant ideology. What follows is by no means the complete story, but it's a perspective that desperately needs to be told at Google. And I think the fact that he was fired for what in many ways is a pretty innocuous paper is an indication that there are some biases within Google. I think that the president just got scared by not addressing gender issues the way he was supposed to, and fired Damore and wrote his anodyne memo without really thinking too much about it. A little while later, Damore says something that really totally confused me. He said, on average, men and women biologically differ in many ways. These differences aren't just socially constructed because they're universal across human cultures. They often have clear biological causes and links to prenatal testosterone. Biological males, for example, that were castrated at birth and raised as females often still identify and act like males. Well, then he goes on to say, the underlying traits are highly heritable. But you can't talk about male-female traits as heritable because every woman is the product of a man and a woman. And so it's not like her female traits are inherited only from her mother. It makes no sense to say that gender-specific traits are highly heritable. Maybe that's just a mistake on Damore's parts, but it seems to be a big misunderstanding of biology. I would be interested certainly in finding out more about biological males being castrated at birth and raised as females. I can't think of a single circumstance where I've heard about this. I do know that there were, for example, eunuchs were quite common in courts. I guess when powerful men had harems, they didn't want their servants to be having sex with their harem. So they would insist that the men who were involved with the harem were neutered. But those men still exhibited some male characteristics. I know in China they had the bizarre practice that they would save the man's testicles, and when he died, he would be buried with his testicles so that he could go to heaven as a fully functional male. But this statement that the biological differences are built in based on what he writes is a little bit weak. Just because human cultures have all tended to have gender differences, some of them definitely are practical. For example, women who are pregnant or breastfeeding are going to have a difficult time going out on a hunt. Men tend to be larger and develop more muscle mass. So obviously in a hunter-gatherer society, there will be significant gender differences, and it's hard to say that those are just imposed by society. But as society became more and more removed from the physical, and computer science is a good example of a job where you're, in some cases, creating virtual worlds where the world can do anything you want, it's hard to say that those gender differences would have a huge impact. Clearly, as I mentioned, child rearing is one place where women and men will forever be different. Only a woman can have a baby, and only a woman can breastfeed. And that is going to have an impact on careers for most women. There are some very powerful and rich women who can have it all. They can have enough help that it doesn't matter that they have a baby. They can go on with their life, and if the baby's crying and it's not convenient for them, they can find somebody to look over them. Damar later says, "We always ask why we don't see women in top leadership positions, but we never ask why we see so many men in these jobs. These positions often require long, stressful hours that might not be worth it if you want a balanced and fulfilling life." Now, I actually agree with Damar here. I think we idealize the top dog. We idealize the person at the top of the heap, the president of the corporation, the president of the company. We assume that these people in these better jobs are there because they're better or because certain people aren't allowed to get there. So the reason why women are not in as many top jobs as men is because they're being prevented from being in these jobs. And it's seen as a benefit to society by people who want gender equity if we have more women there. But it's quite true that if we could have better equity at the top, that would have minimal or no impact on the vast majority of working women. Even if there was equity, the vast majority of women, just like the vast majority of men, are not going to become a president of a corporation. There are a lot of trade-offs in these kinds of jobs. You basically have to devote yourself close to 100% to your job. Traditionally, this has meant that these powerful men have had stay-at-home, usually trophy wives, beautiful women to raise their children and be there for them when they come home, to be with them when they have social events. That has been a tradition for a long time. That's clearly changing, but slowly. And the question is, are there as many women as men who would want to make the sacrifices in order to gain the prestige, the status, and the money that comes with these top jobs? I think Damar is asking a reasonable question. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have more women in top leadership positions, but maybe we should also change the nature of leadership. Maybe we'd be more likely to get more women in top leadership positions if we didn't have such hierarchical structures, if we weren't so obsessed with every corporation driving to produce more profit for shareholders every year. Damar continues in the same vein. Status is the primary metric that men are judged on, pushing many men into these higher paying, less satisfying jobs for the status they entail. Note, the same forces that lead men into high-paced, high-stress jobs in tech and leadership cause men to take undesirable and dangerous jobs like coal mining, garbage collection, and firefighting, and suffer 93% of work-related deaths. Okay, well, there's kind of a mixture of a little bit of intelligence and some things I completely disagree with here. So I agree that status may be more important for men, that society says to a man, you know, if you become a president of a corporation, you have status and we're going to admire you for that. And they might, for a woman, say, you know, are you neglecting your children because you're the president of a corporation? So I think that Damar is saying here that society is pushing men in and pushing women out of these jobs, which is somewhat contradicting his argument that all of this stuff is biological. The idea that men go into coal mining because they're men, in a sense, it's true in these societies. If you live in a town where the only decent paying job is the coal mine and you want to have a family, then you're going to go down into the coal mine. Women, in many cases, weren't allowed to do this. And I think men went into these jobs out of necessity. I think that most men in a coal mining town, if they could get out and do something else, would. But what ties them there, expectations, lack of education, desire to stay close to their family, people end up stuck in those jobs. I think if, say, a different mine opened up without the same health consequences as coal mining, you'd find a lot of men moving over. And if the other jobs opened up without any significant physical danger, you'd probably find a lot of men there too. These jobs often involve a significant amount of physical strength. And another biological reality is that the majority of men have more strength than the majority of women. It's clearly not true in all cases. Men tend to be taller, to have bigger bodies and more muscle. They generate muscle more easily. So even a job like firefighting is going to be easier to get in than women, even though women have made significant encroachments in these jobs. There are the physical realities of body mass, but there are also prejudices. A lot of these jobs, like firefighting and police work, tend to get handed down by a clique from family to family. Because they're well-paying jobs, they come with pensions, with really good benefits. And so naturally, people try to keep the jobs in the family. So women would be seen as a threat in this case. So overall, I think the presence of men in these jobs is a combination of many factors. Some, like strength, are biological, but some are the desire to inherit well-paying jobs. And another thing Damore says is the male gender role is currently inflexible. Feminism has made great progress in freeing women from the female gender role, but men are still very much tied to the male gender role. If we as a society allow men to be more feminine, then the gender gap will shrink, although probably because men will leave tech and leadership for traditional female roles. I'm not sure I agree with this at all. I think there have been great differences in gender and employment over the years. When my father was young, secretaries were pretty much all male. When I was young, secretaries were pretty much all female, and also most primary school teachers. Since then, there's been a movement of men back into traditionally female roles, such as secretary, although it wasn't always, as I pointed out, not always traditionally female, nursing and primary school teaching. I think that feminism has actually made it easier for both men and women to choose their job, their education, in both ways. I would like to see some statistics showing that there hasn't been movement amongst men in terms of getting into professions that were, in the 50 years ago, seen as all female. I mean, prior to the world wars, the vast majority of jobs were men only. And so all jobs, you could say, outside of the home would be traditionally male. And women found it easier to get into some of those jobs, as I mentioned, teaching, secretarial, things like that. But with feminism, it was also now possible to become an engineer, although clearly not as frequently as men. And I think there is less judgmentalism that if a man is a nurse, for example, there was a feeling 40 years ago that he must be gay or something. But I think now a male nurse is just seen as normal. A male primary school teacher is seen as normal, and that's really the way that it should be. Even if we don't achieve 50% equity in every field of employment, there will be enough men and enough women that it's just seen as normal, perfectly normal, for a man or a woman to take that job. Damore attacks basically affirmative actions. He says, I strongly believe in gender and racial diversity, and I think we should strive for more. However, to achieve more equal gender and race representation, Google has created several discriminatory practices. Programs mentoring in classes only for people with a certain gender or race. A high priority queue and special treatment for diversity candidates. Hiring practices which can effectively lower the bar for diversity candidates by decreasing the false negative rate. Reconsidering any set of people if it's not diverse enough, but not showing that same scrutiny in the reverse direction. Setting organization level OKRs, and I don't know what those are, for increased representation which can incentivize illegal discrimination. These practices are based on false assumptions generated by our biases can actually increase race and gender tensions. We're told by senior leadership that what we're doing is both the morally incorrect thing to do, but without evidence, this is just thinly veiled leftist ideology that can irreparably harm Google. This is a standard right-wing critique of affirmative action. But if people have been prejudiced against in the past, whether it was women not being able to do certain jobs, or colored people not being able to do certain jobs, affirmative action is necessary. The question is, and a reasonable question as progress has been made, is when does it end? But claiming prejudice against white men would result in no addressing of the problem. If we said that white men were a special group and gave them priority, then basically everybody's got priority, which means that nobody's got priority. Obviously, if there hadn't been affirmative action, there wouldn't have been the increase of women and people of color in education and in jobs. When I went to university in the 1970s in Canada, which is a pretty high percentage of Native people, I was there when the first Native graduated from the university. Was that because Natives weren't smart enough? Well, it was partly because their education tended to be a lot worse, and because there were a lot of things that were not open to them. Indians just weren't welcome in many parts of society, including education. He goes on, he's now getting pretty political as he goes on. At first he was trying to say that he wasn't really political, but now he's clearly positioning himself on the right and attacking the left. In addition to the left's affinity for those it sees as weak, humans are generally biased towards protecting females. I guess this, he's subtly saying that women are weaker, which in some physical manifestations is true in terms of sheer strength, but it's not necessarily true for all definitions of strength, such as the ability to withstand pain for a long period of time. For example, how many men could have a baby? How many men could stand the pain of having a baby? Anyway, continue with Damore. As mentioned before, this likely evolved because males are biologically disposable and because women are generally more cooperative and agreeable than men. We have extensive government and Google programs, fields of study, and legal and social norms to protect women. But when a man complains about a gender issue affecting men, he's labeled as a misogynist and whiner. Nearly every difference between men and women is interpreted as a form of women's oppression. As with many things in life, gender differences are often a case of grass being greener on the other side. Unfortunately, taxpayer and Google money is spent to water only one side of the lawn. Again, this is kind of an attack on any form of affirmative action. Basically, for centuries, the side of the grass that was being watered was white men. And in the 20th century, there have been more efforts to water the grass on the other side. So it's not really fair to say that only women are getting attention, because there are still many things in society that are easier for men and easier for white people. I believe that the white privilege and the male privilege do exist. And I think that we need programs to change, to improve equity. As I've said before, it has to stop at some point, because at some point you reach equity and then the programs to achieve equity may no longer be needed. And obviously when it comes to education, we're reaching that point, at least in certain fields. And there may be fields where men are struggling and maybe there should be more attention to getting more men. But when you have 20% programmers, I don't think you've got anywhere near the point in time where you need to stop trying to give more opportunities to women. Now, a libertarian would say companies should just do whatever they want. But if that was the case, we'd still have whites-only lunch counters. We would have companies that said, we don't hire women. We don't hire blacks, whatever. So America in particular has come a long way in terms of equity. It still in many ways has a long way to go, but in some places equity has been achieved or dramatically exceeded, such as in the field of psychology. He's now getting a lot more political. While Google hasn't harbored the violent leftist protests that we're seeing at universities, the frequent shaming in our culture has created the same silence and psychologically unsafe environment. He's basically turning a leftist critique of the right on its head. In America, more people have been killed by protesters, by activists on the right, white supremacists, people like that. Second after that are Islamists, which are certainly not on the left. It's a conservative religion, or at least the Islamic terrorists represent a very conservative form of Islam. They certainly don't represent Marxism or something on the far left. So there have been a few cases where protests on the left have reached the level of violence, and that's certainly wrong. But to kind of imply that the campuses are full of violent leftist protests, and to imply by not saying that the same thing is true of people on the right, is certainly not true. And I think he's exhibiting his political biases. What do I think after reading Damore's paper? I think there were some areas where he was right. Biological differences exist, and we will never achieve perfect equity in every field of endeavor. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Computer science, not just at Google, but everywhere, is a bit of a mystery. It seems like the kind of job that should appeal to women as much as men. Is it because it's seen as a more solitary profession? Lots of hours by yourself in front of a screen trying to debug software? Or is it because there are the environment that's preferred by computer scientists is hostile to women? I don't think we really know. And there's certainly nothing in Damore that convinced me that over time there won't be more women getting into computer science. And maybe somebody can identify some of the barriers. Will it ever achieve 50%? Possibly not. Perhaps somebody will identify factors that discourage women from getting into computer science. And maybe some of those factors are innate. Maybe, in other words, that can't be changed because they're biological. And maybe some will be imposed by society. One would think that computer science would be the kind of job that you could take a year off for maternity leave and come back to it and still be a good programmer. And maybe that would mean that you never got to be the president of the corporation. But maybe it would also mean that you could have a really good career balancing being a computer programmer with being a mother, wife, a participant in life as well as in work. Can political correctness go too far? Yes, it can. And I do believe that a lot of men are intimidated into addressing gender issues. It's almost like they're walking into a woman's only field. The phrase mansplaining. And it's true, if a man starts talking about women or whiners because they always complain about pregnancy, a man's talking about something he really has no experience about. But when it comes to gender equity in education and employment, I think men's opinions should be considered valuable. It doesn't mean that men are right and they get to mansplain why Google has only 20% computer scientists. But I think it does mean that women should listen to men. As I mentioned earlier, people are always talking about, let's have a conversation about this. Well, James Damore was trying to start a conversation, and you don't have to start a conversation by being right. You could say, for example, if you're working at Google, that clearly the equity programs at Google aren't having much of an effect. And I think it's because of biological differences between men and women. Presumably somebody would come back and say, well, no, there's other reasons for it. When I was in studying as a computer scientist, I endured a lot of sexist remarks from other students. That's possibly a comeback. There could be lots of different opinions. You would think that you'd want a conversation. I think what happened is Gizmodo, a major new media outlet, characterized this as misogyny. The president of Google was scared to death that if he didn't do anything, he would be seen as weak and misogynist. And so he fired the bastard, Damore, as who I'm talking about. I think it was a really bad decision. There was one part of the memo that I didn't read, the last paragraph, which explained that the president was on vacation at the time. So he probably didn't want to spend a lot of time on this. Because in reality, if he was going to say, okay, we're gonna sit down and we're going to talk about this, we're going to listen to Damore, we're going to talk to him and see whether he shifts on some of his viewpoints or not, see whether this opens up a better discussion within Google and we can come to a better consensus on this. It appears that all high-tech companies are having trouble encouraging women to become computer programmers. And that needs to be discussed. Why is it? Is it ever going to change? Will there be a time when we look at the graduation statistics in every field of science and non-science? It's 50% women. And also the number of blacks, Asians, Hispanics also precisely matches the percentage in the population. Really don't think that's ever going to happen. But on the other hand, there are obvious big historical inequities. So deciding when there has been enough affirmative action, either based on race or based on gender, is not going to be something that's easy. And we should be able to tolerate a variety of opinions. To me, Damore fits into the category of angry white men. Well, he's not terribly angry, but he's certainly pissed off at the way things are. And I think the problem is that a lot of white men are feeling a lot of pain economically, living in a stressful society in many ways, and that pain is real. The mistake is that they're blaming it on identifiable groups. Blacks, Hispanics, women, Muslims, whatever, it's somebody else's fault. Well, it is somebody else's fault. But clearly, the reason why a lot of men ended up going down coal mines and dying was not because those men wanted coal. was because somebody wanted to make a lot of money from coal. And they didn't want to spend money on proper safety equipment, on proper health equipment. They didn't care if a bunch of people died so that they could become fabulously wealthy. And those people still exist. They own a lot of large corporations in America, corporations like Walmart, for example. And it's a lot easier for those people to divert the angry white man into believing that it's not the fault of the big corporations that so many people are struggling in America, but it's a zero-sum game. So if women are to make gains, or people of color are to make gains, then obviously it's because white men are losing. I think clearly the economy and society has grown phenomenally over the past several hundred years. Clearly, there's a lot more available in society for everyone than there ever was. The problem really is the inequity of society. And, okay, so the very richest people in society would have to give a bit in order for the minimum wage to be increased. Maybe the profits of Walmart would go down a little bit. Maybe the cost of products would go up a little bit. But society overall would be better, with the people with minimum wage spending virtually all of their money in the community, not shipping it overseas. The economy and the world could be better for most people. It will never be better for all people. And although Damore has some points, I give him some points for what was written, and although I don't think he should have been fired, he's sitting pretty good having a job as a programmer at Google. He's not exactly suffering. There are a lot of people in the world who are suffering, and some of them are suffering in order to, in third world countries, in order that we can have smartphones and that we can have computers and that we can have cheap clothing and all of those kinds of things. If more women are hired as programmers at Google in the future, is that going to have any impact on Damore? It might even improve his life. And I know that there are leftist activists of all types who are extreme in their viewpoints, and some of their ideas are not realistic, and some would be unfair to other groups. That's true. That's why we need to have a discussion to move into a better place. And I think during the latter part of the 20th century, many advances were made in trying to make a more equitable society, but it seems like the 21st century has been trying to back those off. And I think Damore has kind of bought into this. It's not that everything people in favor of equity say is right, but saying that the status quo is explainable by, for example, women's biology, I don't think is the right answer either. We need to move forwards. Maybe at some point in some areas we need to stop. But it's not like society has yet achieved perfect equality for every identical group in society. One last issue I'd like to address is the free speech snowflake issue. I read a transcript of an interview James Damore recently did, although I would say that the interviewer was quite hostile, polite, but hostile. Damore mostly held his ground and even got some concessions from the interviewee. But at one point, Damore claimed that being a conservative today is a bit like being LGBTQ was. Given that America is run by conservatives, even the Democratic Party is about half conservative and resists most progressive policies, this is rather a stunning thing to say. Conservatives are very big on free speech, on their own free speech, and can say some horrible things about women, about people of color, about gay and trans people, and expect that that's okay because of the First Amendment in the United States. And they love to call progressive snowflakes, mocking their horrified reactions to what are called microaggressions. And yes, progressives at some point, at some times, can take progressivism to the point where discussion is difficult, and where there have been occasions where people have been excluded from certain events because they're white or a man. This is relatively rare. Most progressive groups are mixed with a lot of white, straight men in them. I'm a white, straight man, and I've never had a problem with progressive groups. Well, at least until I start talking about scientific or medical issues. They definitely swallow the Kool-Aid in that department, so I'm not totally in favor of what progressives say or think. But take the example of Heather Heyer, the woman killed in Charlottesville by a car driven by a neo-Nazi. She was white and was demonstrating alongside lots of people of color and other minorities against the neo-Nazis. James Damore was being a snowflake, comparing himself to gay people. Last time I checked, conservatives were not being jailed, beaten, tortured, or killed because they were conservative. Damore lost his job. Not insignificant, but a lot of conservatives have turned something like this into a lucrative media career. There's a lot of rich people who want to fund conservative views. Robert Mercer, the Koch brothers, etc. And all the progressives have is George Soros, who must be spread pretty thin, paying all those protesters at the burgeoning number of demonstrations. So, although I think it was wrong to fire James Damore, a knee-jerk reaction from a busy executive who foolishly thought he could go back to enjoying his vacation by quickly putting the fire out. I don't think Damar's firing is anything akin to Joan of Arc being burned at the stake. I'd really like to know what you think about this. My opinions, Damar's opinions, the president of Google, his critics on the left and the right. Please send me an email and let me know what you think. Thank you very much for listening to episode 150 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.